Hi,
I'm Jennifer, and this is We Are Female and Lawyers. I am not a lawyer yet. However, I wanted to create this podcast as a platform for women lawyers to give us an insight on navigating the legal field and their lives. So, each week, I will be interviewing a different professional to tackle a specific issue or topic. So please, tune in. Before we actually get started, we want to let you know that we have a message feature on our Anchor page. That's anchor.fm/femaleandlawyers. You can record your question and we will feature the question at the beginning of the subsequent episode. Or you can submit a written question to our podcast email at femaleandlawyers, that's with an S, at gmail.com. We would love to hear your questions, so please submit them, especially if you hear something we are not covering, but you are dying to know. That helps us make this show with the listeners in mind. So please, we want you to be a part of this podcast as much as we are. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, we are recording this whole episode remotely. Hello, everyone. This week, I am excited to introduce Miriam Zarraga, an inspiring attorney who now works for the Public Defender's Office in Santa Barbara County. Please introduce yourself and tell everyone a little bit about yourself.
Hi, my name is Miriam Zarraga, and I graduated from law school in May of 2018. Mm-hmm. I got my license in December of 2018 as well. I went to Southwestern Law School, and I'm a public defender now.
So I really want to know about your road to law school. So I guess we'll start with the question of, you know, why did you want to go to law school, or what was the motivation behind you wanting to become an attorney?
So during college, I actually interned with the Inland Empire Latino Lawyers Association, and their focus was to provide legal services to indigent clients. So unlawful detainers, family law petitions, I believe potentially some immigration forms were filled out. Mm. And so I noticed that there was a big need for Latino lawyers and providing services for indigent clients. And so that was, I think at that point, that's when I realized I wanted to go to law school to help provide services for indigent clients. So I went to UC Riverside. And so my last year, that's where I interned with the IELA.
I'm curious to know, obviously you were part of this program. Did you have any guidance in the application or LSAT process?
I actually didn't. My parents, they didn't go to college, law school, anything like that. So I didn't really have guidance. I think most of it, I just did Google searches on how the process works, read the website. Yeah. I had to kind of figure it out on my own.
I think that's pretty much a common thread between us, like first generation college students and then first generation law school students. But then you learn, you know what? We need more Latino lawyers.
Yeah.
You know, we need more Latino lawyers who speak Spanish. We need more Latino lawyers who look like, you know, who look like us, basically, especially in California, where, you know, a lot of the people who you will be representing in a sense, whether it be civil or anything else, will be Latino, yeah. You know?
No, absolutely. And I think that was kind of like talking about like the bilingual aspect. I think that was also another motivator for me was, you know, I realized that being bilingual and speaking both Spanish and English fluently was really going to help me with my clients. And I think, again, growing up and seeing my parents struggle and trying to navigate and figure out like how to just open a bank account, things like that. Yeah. So I think that was another reason why I was like, okay, no, we need more Latino lawyers, you know, someone mm-hmm. that can, you know, who could speak the language and help mm-hmm. this community. So,
yeah. So, you know, I heard you talk about your parents. So how supportive was your family of you wanting to go? We'll start with college, you know, wanting to go to college and then also wanting to go to law school. It's a huge feat in a sense, you know, it's not going to be an easy road, but were they supportive?
Yeah. So yeah, my parents, I think that's where I was very, very lucky. I think I had a really great support system. Both my parents were very, very supportive. You know, I lived with them actually during law school because law school was like an hour with traffic, LA traffic, away. God, yeah. So it wasn't, you know, too bad. I mean, it saved me a lot of money. So, you know, that was another thing where my parents were always great. I think they always instilled in me that education was going to help me move up. And it was something that they always valued. Again, my dad, I think he had the highest level of education he had in Mexico was the second grade. I think my mom's was the sixth grade. So they didn't have this opportunity. So they always said, we'll do anything to try to help you, you know, achieve dreams and, you know, your education goals. And so definitely. I'm very grateful for that, for having parents, my parents.
Yeah. Do you have any advice, I guess, for upcoming students who are going to law school? Like, if you had one piece of advice, I guess, that you would say to them, what would it be?
I think, you know, there's not one way, one right way of doing it. I think you have to figure out what is right for you. Mm-hmm. For example, for me, one of the biggest struggles was that I have ADHD. Mm. And so the way that I was studying, the way that I would read, or again, it was completely different from what the school was saying that should, the way that we should be outlining, the way that we should be reading materials. I had to kind of figure out my own path. And I noticed that when I was trying to do what they were telling us that we should be doing or the way that we should be studying, it didn't work for me. And that was definitely like first semester I struggled because I thought I had to do it exactly how they told me and it didn't work. And then I had to go back and rethink like what works for me. For me, one of the things was, you know, having different binders for different classes, highlighting and color coding things. And that was a big thing for me. And then again, I think it gets easier. I think first year is definitely like a struggle.
Yeah.
And I think anyone's going to tell you that because it is so different.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would be my biggest piece of advice is just don't feel like you have to do what everyone else is doing. Do your own thing.
I think you're right. I think you really have to evaluate yourself and just determine what is going to work for me, while also balancing out what they're telling you. I think what they're telling you to do is correct, but the manner in which you do it has to be tailored to you.
Yeah, no, it's but so true.
But yeah, this was our little advice for you all. This was our little segment of advice. Advice about law school.
Exactly.
Did you join any externships, classes, or clinics? I actually don't know this. Did you while we were in law school?
I did. So, and I think that really helped me in terms of, you know, my job prospects. And I think that really helped me put me in an advantage. So during law school, I try to make sure that I extern. So I externed my first year or first summer. It was with an immigration nonprofit, the Esperanza Immigrant Rights Project.
Oh, yeah.
And so I did that summer. And I loved it so much that I ended up staying like the following semester. And I don't even think I got credit for it. I just really wanted to do it. Yeah. So, I mean, going into law school, that's, you know, what I wanted to do was immigration law. And so I did that. I also externed with two different public defender offices. And I think that's really what solidified my interest in this field. And I remember just finishing up the first semester of my externship and I just realizing that I didn't really feel like work at all, that I just was like, I loved doing it. And I could stay up 9, just like working on little briefs, just because I wanted to help the client.
Yeah.
So I did the immigration clinic as well. That taught me kind of interviewing skills with clients, you know, kind of how to prep for the interviews. I mean, that's something I highly, highly, highly encourage. Because you're going to figure out what is going to, you may think that you're interested in one area of the law, and then the more that you do and explore, you may realize, look, maybe that's not necessarily for me, or yeah, I love this field, but I like this field more. And yeah. So, and it also gives you skills that you can put on your resume that you can build on. And at least it lays a foundation for the first year of practice. And I think, I mean, you're not going to be doing probably the heavy legal work that, you know, you're going to be doing first year. But I think, I mean, it helps you. You know, I worked on some briefs. I got feedback from supervisors. I was able to appear in court through one of my externships. And so I was able to go on the record and get a little comfortable. I mean, I'm not the biggest, I still get nervous with public speaking. And I think that's probably one of the things that I felt, I mean, from where I started to now, I feel like I've made such big, big improvements on everything. So that's one thing I recommend. Just put yourself out there and be involved.
Yeah, I definitely think you're right. Taking the risk in law school is a little bit better, like low risk in a sense, you know?
No, it's true. Yeah, because you're going to have someone supervising you. And I think, you know.
And people get it.
Yeah.
People, I think, are very, especially lawyers and judges, are very forgiving in a sense if someone like messes up. But I think it's true. I think if there was ever a time to take a risk, do it in law school.
Exactly. Yeah. Because, you know, you don't have a bar card. So,
I mean,
like you said, you know, people are a little bit more forgiving.
So now you're a full-fledged lawyer. And I kind of want to know what the process was for you to get a job in Santa Barbara as a public defender, you know, and then whether or not they kind of gave you a lot of training for the position.
Okay. So definitely for public defender, I externed with the Santa Barbara Public Defender's Office before being hired there.
Okay.
And so what I did, I just sent my applications throughout a bunch of public defender's offices, and I heard back from some of them, some I didn't. Mm. And I got interviews, and that's kind of how I got the position. I think one of the biggest things that I would recommend for anyone who is interested in having a post bar or a job with the public defender's office is being very conscious of the community that you want to work with. And you don't have to necessarily have this extensive public defender, you know, volunteering or working with the public defender's office, because from what I've seen, not everyone has that background. But serving the community that the public defender office is going to be serving.
Yeah, definitely. What does your day-to-day look like?
As
a public defender?
So, I mean, that's a good question. I think it really varies. You know, I'm either in court in the morning, you know, or, you know, sometimes in the afternoon, or I'm in the office.
Okay.
But most of the time I am kind of do a little bit of, you know, I'll have an arraignment assignment for day of the week. I have my own calendar on right now. It's Tuesdays. And then we have the trial calls Wednesday mornings. So sometimes I'll be in the trial call dates for the misdemeanors. I'm currently a misdemeanor attorney.
Okay.
Is on Wednesdays. And so on those days, I may be there though from 8:30 to 12. Because it's also on the felony day. So it's just, you know, I'll be, you know, kind of sending emails, reviewing discovery. I mean, and again, usually I try to set up client meetings in the afternoon. So sometimes a bunch of, you know, meetings back to back. You know, usually my motion writing I do at home.
Okay.
It is a little bit like all over the place, but I like it. I think it keeps you on your toes.
Mm-hmm.
You just never know when you're going to have to go into court. So it's a nice, like, different, like, everyday experience.
Yeah. For those listeners, I guess, and I hope we do have some who are thinking about going to law school, can you just explain what the difference between a misdemeanor and a felony is, when it comes to, I guess, your representation of it?
So, well, felonies are a lot more, you know, they're more serious. There's prison time involved, longer sentences. So there's a lot of consequences to a felony. With a misdemeanor, there's still criminal charges.
Mm-hmm.
But usually if you receive a sentence, you're going to be able to do the time in jail. You know, the stakes are a little bit lower, but again, that's not to say that this again, that it's not important. That it's not important. Hopefully one day I'll move up to felonies, even though, again, it's, you know, it is scary because the stakes are a lot higher. And the rights that people have felonies, they lose a lot of rights, you know, the prospects of employment go low, you know, they go down. So that's just kind of like a very general difference between felonies and misdemeanors.
And then let us know kind of what your process is with a specific client. Like what's the start point? What's the end point?
So like, you know, when I receive like a new case, what I'll do is, you know, I try to review the file, look at the complaint, look, if I'm not familiar with the charge, I look at the CalCrim, the jury instructions to kind of give me a basic, you know, kind of like an element breakdown of the offense. I'll review discovery. And then once I do that, once I review the whole file, then I'll set up an appointment either via phone or, you know, in person with the client. And so I think one of the, I mean, obviously with COVID, that's changed the format of how I'm doing things. So I'm doing things a little bit more, you know, on the phone, or I'm trying to make myself available with like Zoom meetings. But yeah, so usually, you know, I'll try to meet with them, kind of get their overall goals. What is it that they want to do in their case? Are they looking to just resolve it, get the best, you know, disposition possible? Are they looking to further investigate this matter and potentially take this to trial? So I think having a general idea of what it is that your client wants is a very, very important thing that you want to first thing, you know, going into a new case.
Yeah, definitely.
My ending of the representation is either the client is going to enter into a plea or they're going to take their case and, you know, take it to trial.
Right, right, right. Have you seen any added difficulty either meeting with your clients or speaking with your clients because of COVID-19?
I think it is a lot harder. Well, yes and no. I think it's harder because a lot of my clients may not necessarily have a phone. They can't afford it. They're indigent. And so usually, I mean, the only way that I can really have a conversation with those clients is having in-person meetings or seeing them in court. And we just don't have that. And so that's been probably one of the biggest issues is for those, you know, for those certain clients is it's almost impossible to try to communicate with them. And it's, again, it's not within their control. And so with other clients who do have access to a phone, it has helped in some way that we're able to communicate, you know, from home. You know, they don't have to come into the, you know, the office if they don't want to. I think probably one of the bigger issues is probably looking through discovery together. You know, some of my, a lot of my clients don't have computers or, you know, smartphones, so they can't look at what I'm looking at. So I think that's one of the harder things where it's kind of, you know, for some of my cases, it is pushing us a little bit back if they're interested in reviewing the discovery themselves. So far, I haven't really had that issue come up. Only one client I think has had, you know, where they want to take a look at everything together and meet in person. But it's kind of like a good and a bad.
Yeah. Do you feel like, and, you know, obviously you touched on this a little bit about what your clients kind of their background is and, you know, what they have access to and what they don't have access to. But do you feel like being bilingual, being Latino, do you feel like it somehow has helped you? Especially when it comes to communication and being able to explain things to your clients?
I think it has to a certain extent. I think it has because, again, with most of my clients, you know, probably half of my clients are either Spanish speaking or Mixteco speaking. I don't speak Mixteco. That's an indigenous language from Mexico. And there's, I can't remember how many different types of Mixteco, but it varies by region. And they're somewhat different. So, you know, one, you know, Mixteco speaker may not necessarily understand the other one. So it has helped me. So
for those specific clients,
Spanish. And again, I try to, you know, keep things as simple as possible. You know, keeping in mind their education level, I think sometimes it just helps to have, someone that looks like them represent them, or just to listen to them and communicate in their language. So I think that's, you know, it's helped me in my representation. I haven't had this come up a lot, but it has. For some clients, I feel like they have kind of put me as part of the system. So they may not necessarily see me as, you know, someone on
trustworthy
their-
or
exactly.
Yeah.
And I've had that, you know, I've had some clients say, oh, well, you're just, you know, what do you want me to do? Like, what do you guys want me to do? You guys just want me to, you know, what do you want me to plead
almost?
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's just, it's kind of sad when I hear that, because I'm trying to figure out what can I do to prevent that from happening. And again, there might not be much I can do. But it's definitely, that has come up. I think right now, because I am, you know, in Santa Maria, I think the biggest demographic is probably Latino, or it might be the same as, you know, my white clients. But those are like the biggest demographics. And then, and then within the Latino community, you know, unfortunately we have a lot of farm workers. We have a lot of immigrants, and a lot of people who don't speak Spanish, and speak the, you know, Mixteco, the indigenous languages. And so I think something that I've been trying to work on is how can I better explain certain concepts to these, you know, to these clients so that they understand what's going on. Because a lot of the times they are confused.
So people should understand this too. And I know you kind of explained this, but, and you know, Spanish is not the same as Mixteco, right? So it's difficult for you. I mean, you know, it's like if someone who have never taken a Spanish class is trying to explain something to someone in Spanish. So it's the same thing for us. So what do you think can help kind of bridge that gap between people who speak this language versus, you know, everyone else who you're trying to represent, I guess?
I mean, one of the things that I wish we had was more Mixteco speaking attorneys. I'm not sure how we can do that, but that would be amazing. And I think probably more diversity in the legal field. You know, the other thing I think is a lot of, you know, just understanding of different cultures, of different languages from the courts. You know, I've definitely, you know, had situations where the court may assume that because there's this one Mixteco interpreter that somehow they speak the same dialect, you know, as, you know, again, there's different types of Mixtecos. There's from different regions. Right. And that's the problem because, again, my clients cannot, you know, waive their constitutional rights if they are not having the right interpreter interpret for them. Right. So I think, you know, again, just having a little bit of just cultural awareness from the court, I think would be helpful too.
Yeah. People need to understand that more. And
I think the other thing is, you know, just understand that, you know, in certain cultures, something may be appropriate, but maybe, you know, we, you know, here in the United States don't necessarily understand that. And I think it's just, you know, just being aware of that, you know, because I think there's definitely been like some, you know, child cruelty, you know, those charges where, you know, the parents are disciplining their children. But.
Oh, that's such a good point. Like, even when it comes to like your own familial. Okay, so go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
No. So, I mean, yeah, exactly. So it's just, I feel like sometimes, you know, we do have a large immigration population. I think sometimes the courts do probably need to be a little bit more aware that there are different cultures and that, again, you know, if we give the tools that these individuals need to understand that, you know, maybe certain, you know, things are not appropriate here in the United States, without necessarily giving them a criminal charge, especially if it's something not, you know, particularly egregious, I think that might be a better way to handle things, because otherwise the individual's coming back and they're not understanding why is it that I keep getting in trouble or why is it that I, you know, I think that's another issue.
Yeah, I think that's important. And I don't think we've talked about that enough, I think, on this podcast about the importance in legal education of just the everyday person, mm-hmm. right? Just the most basic things, whether it's rights, like we talked about here, you know, or whether it's specific laws or infractions or, you know, things that maybe to a regular person, even whether they're diverse or not, really, to be honest, it's just something that they might not even be aware of that is as egregious in the legal eyes as it is. I think that's important. I think we kind of lack that sometimes. And I think I wish there was more community engagement when it came to that, because rather than them getting in trouble and this being your first time you touch the legal field while you're in handcuffs in front of a court, I think it would have been more productive had they known maybe some of their rights or laws or specific things that they shouldn't have done prior to that, so that you don't get to that point, so that you don't give them a criminal record, so that they now don't have a difficulty finding a job because of a criminal exactly. record. I think that's so important sometimes that people don't realize that all of this matters. Like, you know, whether something becomes a misdemeanor or a felony matters. Mm-hmm. Whether something shows up on the record or doesn't will matter. Mm-hmm. You know, this could, for all intents and purposes, be the fork in the road where you're going to make that determination for them, whether or not yeah. you specifically, but the court, you know, will make the determination of whether or not their life turns out a specific
way. I think you definitely made like some very good points about like the community engagement, how can we give people, you know, just, you know, the knowledge and the education that they need in order to just stay out of the system. And I think,
yeah, like you said, the tools, you know.
Yeah, and yeah. I think another, like you mentioned, I think another big problem is just that, you know, I think sometimes the courts or the system just forgets that, you know, like you mentioned, like having a felony or a misdemeanor, like it's no small thing, and it really does affect the course of someone's life. And, you know, yeah. it might seem something that's minor, but, you know, again, even if it's a misdemeanor, an employer is going to see that. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, to me, it doesn't, you know, yeah. again, I would want to probably know a little bit more, but, yeah. you know,
there are people out there who will automatically just look at this and say, oh, well, I have 5 other applicants who have
exactly.
nothing.
So it really does affect, you know, how people, like their course of their future. And it's, you know, it's just unfortunate that sometimes we don't, you know, some people just don't see that.
Yeah. I guess I'll go to the specific question of, have you had or felt any differences because you are, you know, a woman lawyer?
I think I definitely have. I think, you know, I don't know if this is something that some individuals are conscious of. Mm. And, you know, I obviously don't ever want to think negative thoughts, but I've definitely had that experiences where, you know, maybe older male attorneys may, you know, just the tone, they kind of talk down, or as if I don't know what I'm talking about, or they have to mansplain things. So that's definitely
come yeah, up. People mansplaining is a real thing.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. So that's, you know, it comes, I mean, you know, definitely in the court that's happened to me. And it, I don't know if it could be necessarily because I'm a woman, or maybe I'm, you know, relatively new. But definitely there's been some interactions where, you know, it does make you feel a little bit like uncomfortable, because you're like, well, are you explaining these things to me because I'm a woman? Like, you don't think I can
that I could process this
exactly,
or what?
Or like, I haven't done my, you know, my due diligence,
my work. Exactly.
Yeah. And so it's kind of an issue. And I, you know, just even with opposing counsel, I may be speaking and I'll just get interrupted. And again, I'm not sure if it's because I'm a woman. With clients, it could vary. You know, I am, you know, 4'11", so I'm, you know, really, you know, this, you know, tiny little attorney. You know, again, and this is very rare, but I think sometimes some clients may also, you know, because I look younger, because I am, you know, petite, and I'm a woman, I don't know if they are not inclined to listen to what I have to say, or, you know, they don't necessarily think that I'm right, or they'll, you know, come back and they'll say, well, you know, I heard this or I heard that, why am I not getting this? And I'll try to, you know, show them the penal code. I'll say like, look, this is exactly why, this is where I'm getting my information. I'm not sure what, you know, what you're hearing or what those circumstances or what those cases were about. Those are, you know, some interactions that I've definitely had.
Definitely some added difficulties, I feel like, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know we talked about being a woman lawyer, but how about being a minority lawyer?
Yeah, I think I've definitely been in the courtroom and I've had another attorney come up to me and say, hey, like, can you help me interpret this for this client? Like immediately didn't even, you know, say, hey, like, I'm sorry, are you an interpreter?
Do you speak Spanish?
Exactly. Yeah. He just immediately came up to me and just said, hey, like,
oh, he thought you were an interpreter.
He thought I was an interpreter. And it's happened to me twice already in like the 1.5 year of practice. So I don't think it's probably going to be the last time. And luckily the bailiff that was standing right there, she said, you know, she's an attorney just like you.
Oh, I love that.
So that was like pretty great to kind of
not have to say it myself, but have someone else be like, no.
Exactly. Because it was really like, I was just like kind of shocked. I was like, what is this about? Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think another person that looks different than me would have had that experience.
Interesting.
Yeah. And despite me, you know, having my suit on and having, you know, a stack of files in my hand.
Oh my God, read the room, guys.
I know, it was like so awkward. And that was like one of the experiences that I've had that I can give you like a concrete detail.
Yeah.
I haven't had that many negative experiences so far.
Which is good.
Yeah, which is good.
Yeah, yeah.
But I definitely, like from judges, a lot of the judges are a little bit older. So sometimes there's been definitely some comments that have been made about, you know, little gangbangers and I'm in the room. And so that makes me, you know, I mean, how are you supposed, like, what are you supposed to say to that, you know?
And, exactly.
Or, you know, I was advocating for one of my clients who was Latino, and he brought a, you know, kind of like a knife into school or something like that, or a fake gun. And so I try to conference that and see if we can get his case diverted, dismissed, you know, have him do community service, you know, first real offense.
Oh, first time offender. Oh,
first time. Yeah, like didn't even have a juvie record.
Okay.
And so I was
get this kid help. Yeah, if anything,
like,
not, you know?
Exactly. Like it wasn't, you know, he wasn't violent. He was just, you know, a photograph he took with his friends. Not probably not the smartest thing, but he
obviously,
you know,
obviously, like we're not excusing, you know, the actual whatever he did, but
yeah. And so a comment that the judge made was like, well, you know, here's like a little gangbanger. He needs to, you know, realize he can't, like, you know, if we don't do something about this now, he's going to be coming back as like a felony gang, you know, member or something. And part of me was like, well, you know, are you just saying that because he's Latino who has no, absolutely no record? Or are you like, would you say the same thing with like a white kid, you know?
Yeah. And let's be real, they wouldn't. Like, I'm sorry, but I'm just going to say it because it's true. Because I think had he been another race, I don't think that's what the same conversation that would be happening. I think it would be like, well, he has so much promise. He's going to do this. We don't want to mark his life up. We want to make sure that, you know, he goes on the right path as opposed to being labeled off the bat because of his race. Something that, oh, well, what if he becomes a gangbanger? Well, what if he becomes a president? like in my mind, if we're going to such extremes at this point, it's like, well, what if he does this? Or fine, then what if he does this?
Yeah.
It's just so unfortunate. I can't imagine like being in that room and just being like having to kind of like bite your lip, because that's essentially what you have to do, you know, and just being like, well, I'm still going to advocate for my client, but
yeah. And I think that's, you know, I think maybe some people are starting to be a little bit more conscious of that.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes for older attorneys or older, you know, more judges,
more seasoned people. Yeah.
Yeah. They just sometimes don't, I don't know if that was something that was, you know, appropriate back, you know, like a couple years ago, but I hopefully, you know, they start
moving
to realize
forward,
that
that's
not,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that has been very, it was, you know, little comments like that. And again, I don't know if, you know, they don't necessarily see that that's an issue to make comments like that. But, you know, I mean, luckily my client wasn't there. So that's, you know, the good thing, he didn't hear that. But you know, I definitely had to hear that.
Ugh, no, that's horrible.
Yeah.
It's so true that the one good caveat of that was that he wasn't in the room to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm sure it's far more detrimental to know that these are the conversations that are happening about, you know, regarding your future and your life and who you are. And
yeah,
it's tough.
Yeah. I mean, I guess a positive to being, so I know any difference experiences because you're a woman, but right. A positive that I think sometimes it is helpful is, one, it's connecting with, you know, clients. Not all clients are male. So having a female as your attorney, I think that sometimes can help you or help, you know, you connect with your client because, one, they feel more, a little bit more comfortable opening up. I've had clients who have been sexually assaulted in the past, and they were able to open up about that, and we were able to work towards getting a dismissal because of that experience and because she felt comfortable opening up. And so I think that's a positive. If we can have more female lawyers, I think that's always great.
That's such a good point.
Yeah, it's just, you know, and I know in immigration law, that's another big thing. You know, there's a lot of, I know when I dealt a little bit with asylum, that was, you know, one of the things that I felt like helped me was to connect to the young female clients, the little girls who had experienced terrible things and they were comfortable enough to open up.
No, that's such a good point because I will say this, you know, and it's true. We go through all these experiences that women go through, but it's so true. I think this is just as important to show why it is we need more women lawyers, how we're really kind of changing the field, and how if we have more women lawyers, these are all the positive outcomes that could happen because of it. And I think that's such a good point. Yeah. So I guess my next question is, obviously we live in a system in the US nationwide where we kind of follow this innocent until proven guilty. What are your thoughts on that?
My experience has been that, you know, juries that I've had to do the voir dire on is there's definitely an attitude and a sentiment that's, you know, that they have, or a lot of people have, that it's guilty until proven innocent, that we as, you know, defense counsel or the defendant have to show that they're innocent. And so I think for me, that's been probably one of the hardest things because, you know, I always like to think, you know, positive. And I always like to say, I'm so happy that, you know, we live in a country that somehow, you know, has a judicial system in place, and, you know, you can't just shoot people in the street. My mom, you know, mentioned in Guatemala, sometimes they might do that where they used to. But I mean, yeah, my experience has been, I've heard from jurors or potential jurors that, yeah, they would probably hold it against my client if he didn't testify or she didn't testify. That
Which is in their rights, first of all, in their constitutional rights. Oh my God.
Exactly. Or I've definitely heard comments, they're innocent, then they will defend themselves. They'll say something. And so them, you know, not taking the stand, regardless of what the reason is, then they must be hiding something. Or, you know, I've definitely heard others say, well, the DA wouldn't have been filing something if there wasn't some kind of
enough evidence. Oh my God, yeah. You're kidding.
That there must be something to it and that we have to show that it's not the case. So, you know, again, depending on what type of case there is, like there are sometimes quite, you know, comments say, you know, said that, you know, law enforcement can never be wrong.
Oh, that's the other narrative that you hear a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think,
or they're always honest. They never lie. Why would they lie?
Exactly. And so it's, you know, it is kind of in a way just kind of discouraging to kind of hear that, you know, people have these attitudes. And I think unless you've ever been on the other side, you may not necessarily, you may always kind of have these thoughts. And so
there's a lot of stacks against you.
Yeah, because then you kind of go in and you have to be like, well, I know my client doesn't have to testify. And I know we may strategically choose not to, or he may not want to, or she may not want to. But then are they going to be holding that against my client if they do assert that right?
Yeah.
So it's just, yeah, it's definitely, I feel like the system is kind of that way. I think, you know, I mean, just the way that, again, you know, we usually are going to be in the courtroom. We stand when the jurors are coming in. And I've definitely had cases where the potential jurors are already just kind of looking at my client and they're all like squinting and kind of giving them dirty looks.
Like almost like, what did you do?
Exactly.
Like, why are we here type thing? Oh, exactly. My God.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, it's frustrating, but I think it's that keeps me going. It's just kind of showing people like, look, you may think the system is perfect, but it's not. Just because someone is being charged with something doesn't mean that they're guilty. You know, the government has the burden to prove it. We don't have to prove anything. We literally can sit here and not, you know, do anything. Mm-hmm. But obviously, I think there's some bias sometimes that people have that.
Do you feel like both the pool and the people who get chose is really diverse, or do you feel the demographic is just a little bit more different than as opposed to, like, let's say LA?
So no, there's definitely the demographics in Santa Barbara County is not as, I feel, diverse as LA in terms of the jury pool. You know, I think there is some diversity in Santa Barbara. Mostly it's, you know, Latino and white. You know, that's kind of what makes the majority of the population from what, you know, from the stats that I've seen.
Okay.
But definitely the jury pool, you know, I've had clients who are people of color, and the jury pool is predominantly white, older, probably more educated, wealthier. So it's not diverse. And I'm not sure, you know, one, if it's just who qualifies or how they're being chosen. I mean, it's supposed to be kind of random, and it's supposed to be, you know, a pool of, you know, peers, but is it though? And so, yeah, that's definitely, I think that's another issue is, you know, how can we get this to be more diverse? And again, I remember in one of the, this was a case that didn't necessarily go to trial, but we did do like 3 days of voir dire. And the pool like started off diverse. Right. So then when we started to go through, it didn't reflect that pool. And it was really discouraging to kind of come to that realization that my client potentially was not going to get a fair trial. And I think that was ultimately why my client ended up taking a plea was because he started to see that this wasn't probably going to be
for
the
him.
Most
yeah,
fair.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, I think at the end of the day, you need to have two sides, right?
Yeah.
I think it's only fair, but I think
it is
difficult, you know, and again, I don't know if it's necessarily, I think some people, it's just this like underlying bias that they have that may live in a sheltered, you know, kind of world where they never had, you know, any negative
exposure.
And so it's just, I think that's the one thing where the more I do it, the more I realize that it's just the system is not really fair. If you start off with having these attitudes that somehow the defense has to prove the innocence, that's not you can't necessarily have a fair trial when that's the type of people who are on the jury.
Exactly. What do you think are things that they can do to kind of prepare themselves for being in a jury pool?
I think probably the key is to just be honest. Be honest when answering questions. Don't be afraid to speak up and say what's on your mind. There's always an opportunity to go back in chambers and have just a private, you know, if there's issues or concerns and you're concerned about putting that out in front of the jury pool, you can always, you know, speak with counsel and the judge in private. But again, I think it's really important to just be honest and, you know, recognize that you may have these underlying biases, recognizing that there are certain issues that you have that may taint how you see the evidence presented in front, you know, to you, and own the biases, and that way we can have a fair trial for whoever it's going to be. And again, you know, I don't think there's an issue with just being honest.
That's so well said. That was so well said. I think I agree. You know, I completely agree. So as our last segment, I'm curious if you'd like to share maybe what are some things that if people do find themselves either in front of a police officer, what do you think there are some things that they should know about their specific rights?
Biggest thing is just, you know, trying to stay calm, because you don't want, not to say that things won't escalate, but I think trying to stay calm is, you know, one of the things that does help in interactions. The other thing is, you know, you have a right to remain silent. And I think a lot of people, and from what I've seen, just even going through police reports and when I'm looking at you know, files. Yeah. And one of the biggest thing is that my clients will sometimes, you know, speak and then they'll like say all these things and, you know, they might be sarcastic. I have a client right now, sarcastic, and anything that you're saying can be used against you. Right. And it will.
Right.
And I think a lot of the times, just from what I've seen so far in my limited experience, I've seen, you know, a lot of times officers will try to be friendly with my clients or defendants, and they'll try to gather information and they'll try to do it in a way that, you know, they're just trying to be friendly and have the client open up.
Almost having like a conversation.
Exactly.
But really, you know what it is. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think, I've heard officers say, you know, if you help me, if you're honest with me, we'll figure something out. You may not get in trouble or things along those lines.
Oh my God.
You know, those are lies. You know,
they're there to gather
information and use what you say against you and, you know, trying to get probable cause to search you.
Right.
So I think that's the biggest thing, is just recognizing that, you know, you have a right to remain silent and that, you know, don't necessarily believe everything the officers say, because it, you know, may not necessarily be true.
And that's such a good point. And I think that's important. Just making sure too that it, once you assert it, remain silent. Less is more. Yes. Thank you so much, Miriam.
Thank you so much.
This was such a good one.
Bye.